Well, thank you very much for that kind introduction, and it's on the contrary, I am very grateful for your time and attention, and in fact for the hospitality that I've received so often from this wonderful community here. I came here under the auspices of United Israel Appeal to help in their campaign for Israel, and I have to say that this being my first visit to Australia, it's a wonderful thing to encounter a community so unified, so engaged with Israel, with so much learning and so much piety and so much spirit. So it's enormously gratifying to be with you. And it's particularly gratifying to be able to address the problems which we're all concerned with, which brought all of us here tonight, in the city of Melbourne, where the problems all began. I'll explain what I mean in a moment. Now, you bear a certain responsibility for these issues, which I'll explain as we get along. But without further ado, when we talk about Israel in isolation at the moment, what we all really mean is that Israel has been isolated from its most important ally in a way that really never occurred in the last generation. The demand by the Obama administration that Israel effectively freeze construction and settlements and effectively abandon the settlements is an extremely grave step on the part of the United States, and I believe constitutes a betrayal of the state of Israel, which has to be looked at in the most serious possible terms. As I'm sure many of you are aware, when the government of Israel agreed to a unilateral withdrawal from Gaza, which was a difficult and dangerous decision to make, and one which I think most Israelis, particularly ones in the range of Palestinian rockets, now regret, the government of Israel received from the Bush administration assurances that in return for the withdrawal from Gaza, Israel would be given flexibility in dealing with the settlements in the West Bank. The existence of such agreements were made public by Elliot Abrams, coincidentally a member of my shul in New York, who was the National Security Council Deputy Director under the Bush administration, who negotiated these agreements. These were published in the Wall Street Journal and other venues. So for the Obama administration to turn around and say, no, we're simply going to tear up the existing agreements, is viewed by Israel in the gravest possible terms. As a former Israeli ambassador to the United States explained, if there ever were to be a permanent agreement with the Palestinians, it would not be possible without American guarantees. But if an American guarantee is valid only so long as an administration remains in office, how is it possible for Israel to accept such a guarantee? How did it come to this? As a matter of fact, how did a number of things come about? And I'd like to put the administration's actions towards Israel in the context of another incident, which I'm sure all of you are painfully aware of, which is the August 17th report in the Swedish daily Aftonbladet, reviving the old blood libel. Aftonbladet decided to publish the unsubstantiated, rumor-laden report of a freelance journalist arguing that the Israel Defense Force was systematically murdering Palestinians in order to harvest their organs and sell them on the black market. About the manufacture of matzah with Palestinian blood, they said nothing. I suppose they'll wait for Pesach to bring that up. But this was an extraordinary thing because there was no evidence at all. I've worked for major newspapers. Many of you know what a major newspaper consists of. In liberal, educated Sweden, the home of the Academy of Sciences, the home of the Nobel Prize, the arbiter of excellence in Western culture, this liberal democracy, the editors of the leading daily chose to let through the editorial process an absolutely outrageous, inflammatory, unsubstantiated piece of venom and sat back with their arms folded and defended it afterwards. And the editor of Aftenblatt was asked about it, and he said, well, it's true we don't have any evidence for this report, but we think it worth investigating. And, of course, if it turns out not to be true that the Israel Defense Force is systematically murdering Palestinian civilians in order to harvest their organs and make money with them in the black market, you know, we'll have found out something interesting. You could say the same things about Jews poisoning wells and murdering babies and, you know, whatever. It's an extraordinary thing. And we sit back as Jews and look at this and say, how could it possibly have come to this? Let me step back and suggest a somewhat different way of looking at it than we typically look at. New friends here, one of my sponsors from the United Israel Appeals, asked me, well, isn't this classical anti-Semitism rearing its head? And my response is, we should be so lucky. What we're dealing with is something worse than classical anti-Semitism. And I'll get to what that is in a moment. But let's look at the origin of the situation. We're told that, well, we were told back in the 1990s, the young people here won't remember, but everyone my age will remember this vividly, when the Prime Minister of Israel, Yitzhak Rabin, shook hands with the terrorist Yasser Arafat on the White House lawn in 1993, an encounter arranged by a young Clinton administration aide named Rahm Emanuel, who's back in the White House with Obama. We were told we had to do this, as much as we detested Arafat, who was a murderer, an absolutely revolting character. Robbie knew this. We were told we needed to do this because of the demographic time bomb. The Muslim womb would overwhelm us. We'd have so many Arabs that they would swamp the smaller Jewish numbers in the state of Israel, so we had to reach out to Tripoli, where this murderer Arafat was living in exile, bring him back so he could take all of these fecund Palestinians breeding like rabbits off our hands and put them in a separate state so they wouldn't swamp our numbers. That was possibly the worst judgment and the poorest forecast made by anybody in politics in the 20th century. What's happening in the Arab world and the Muslim world more generally is something vastly different. The Muslim world, a fifth of humankind, is in profound crisis and is profoundly fragile. We're seeing rates of demographic decline, rates of evaporating fertility that have never been observed in world history. I mean, if you're a demographer these days and you want to see something totally extraordinary, and study the weirdest and strangest phenomenon, the closest equivalent to the duck-billed platypus in the field of demographics, is what's happening to Iran. Iran is a country, to paraphrase Oscar Wilde, that's gone from infancy to senility without passing through adolescence. Remember, Islam is a religion of traditional society, of rigid hierarchy, unquestioning obedience, strict prescription. The notion of the sanctity of the individual and individual imitation of God, which includes the creative powers of mankind, which is fundamental to Judaism and was taken up by Christianity, never made it into Islam. Allah is the all-transcendent being with whom man can have no possible comparison. The idea of a human being imitating God, of imitatio Dei, as the Western tradition calls it, is an absurdity in Islam, because Allah is the absolute power who can do whatever he wants and sort of recreates the world at will at any particular moment. As Franz Rosenzweig, the great German Jewish philosopher, said, Allah is less the equivalent of Hashem or of the Christian God than the whole pantheon of pagan deities rolled up into what? An arbitrary absolute God. So imitatio Dei does not exist. It's a culture which can't foster creativity. That's why for the last 800 or 900 years, since mainstream Islam was settled in the Al-Ghazali tradition, We've not heard the name in the civilized world of a single Muslim in any field of human endeavor. I mean, there's a Pakistani chemist who won the Nobel Prize, but you simply don't find Muslims of talent. The one Arab writer on the short list for the Nobel Prize, the Syrian poet who calls himself Adonis, says, what destroys the Arab mind is Islam and the Quran, because the Quran requires such absolute obedience, a suspension of reason, that the individual can't exist. So you take people who live in a hierarchy of rigid certainties, thrust them into the sunlight of the modern world, and what you get is a train wreck. This is not simply my view. This is the premise of modern political Islamism. This was the view of Hassan al-Banna, the Egyptian who in the 1920s created the Muslim Brotherhood and all the Islamists who followed in his footsteps. And their fears of the fragility of the Muslim world, of its inability to engage modernity, have been amply fulfilled in the demographic catastrophe that's modern Iran. 25 years ago, the average Iranian woman had 6 children. Today, the average Iranian woman has 1.5 children. You've gone from fertility levels associated with Africa to fertility levels associated with Germany in the matter of a single generation. Nothing like this has ever been observed before. And reading through the demographic literature, the demographers are stunned by this. It's a phenomenon that no one's able to explain in traditional terms, or conventional terms of demography. I assert that it's because of Islam's incapacity to deal with the modern world, precisely the incapacity that the Islamists themselves cite as the foundation of their political movement. So we saw on television these mass demonstrations by young Iranians against a regime whom they despise. Young people who don't have children are not traditional Muslims. They've gone right from the most rigorous kind of controls to sex, drug, and rock and roll. And out of the Iranian education and health ministries, we've been seeing leaks of studies of the condition of the young people, which have them in an absolute panic. You have a rate of drug addiction, I mean hard drug addiction, in Iran 10 times that of the United States per capita. You have in Tehran alone 300,000 prostitutes. And according to the Iranian studies, they're not sort of runaway teenagers from poor families. They're university women who now consider it perfectly normal to earn tuition through prostitution. You have a society which has lost its moral compass and lost its bearings, an older generation holding on to power by employing bully boys out of the provinces who've got the guns and can keep things under control in the streets, as we've seen, with a young literate class which wants nothing at all to do with the regime, which is apathetic, miserable, and disaffected, but also powerless. You've got a huge number of young people today in Iran because 25 years ago, their mothers had an average of 6 children. They're having no children. 20 years from now, Iran is going to have the same demographic profile as Germany or Italy or Japan. A huge number of old people and no young people to care for them. Now, in Japan, with per capita income of $40,000 or $50,000 a year, you can hire the Filipino and Indonesian nurses to take care of you and slowly fade into the sunset. You can manage that with the amount of wealth a country like Japan has. Iran has per capita income of $6,000 of GDP, and that's all based on oil, which will have run out in 20 years in any case. So Iran is facing a demographic and economic and natural resource depletion catastrophe all at the same time. And if you're Ahmadinejad or Ayatollah Khomeini, and you look at this, you look at the mess you've got, the disaffection of your young people, the inability to control society except by the bullet and the whip, and you look around you and you have the Shiites of Lebanon, who you pay through Hezbollah, you've got the Hazara Shiites of Afghanistan, you have the Saudi oil fields, which happen conveniently to be located on the southern shore of the Persian Gulf in areas with a Shiite majority. You look at Iraq, which has a Shiite majority and a bunch of oil. You look north to Azerbaijan, which used to be called northern Iran, and you think, I've got it. I have a divine inspiration. It's the Shiite moment. Either we break out or we break down. Iran is in exactly the same position, economically, that Adolf Hitler described to his generals on the eve of the invasion of Poland, that the economy was about to break down, and if they didn't launch the war then, the regime would be thrown out of power. It's a famous speech by Hitler to his generals. Iran is not something you can negotiate with. I mean, think of a bank robber who's taken hostages in the course of a robbery who's dying of cancer in any case. It's a wounded beast. Now, simply because Iran is a fragile society doesn't mean that it's not dangerous. For the whole last half of the 19th century, Turkey was described as the sick man of Europe, but that didn't prevent Turkey during and after World War I from murdering 3 million Christians in the course of its extermination of the Armenians and its war with Greece. Iran is a wounded beast and a dangerous one. And you look south from Iran to Iraq, where this country cobbled together by British cartographers in the 1920s with no basis to live together, populated by three peoples, Kurds, Sunnis, and Shiites, who hate each other, who were three separate Ottoman provinces, never had business as being in the same country. You look over to Pakistan, which was in a civil war in which the Taliban claims its authority on the basis of its ability to sort out those nasty heretical Shiites who were 20% of the Pakistani population and allied with Iran. You go through, in fact, the whole of Central and Western Asia, from Lebanon to Afghanistan, and you have societies that are either imploding in civil war or on the verge of civil war. You have a fifth of humankind, which is in desperate trouble. And that's not something about which to express schadenfreude. Because the more the Muslim world shows symptoms of disintegration, the more these problems will be laid at the door of Israel by the liberal elite of the West. And that's our problem. Barack Obama said, we absolutely must have an Israeli-Palestinian settlement. Why is that? Because if we solve legitimate grievances of the Palestinians with respect to Israel, then I can go to the Iranians and get a deal with them. Now, Alan Dershowitz, who sadly supported Obama in his electoral campaign, wrote in his blog in the Jerusalem Post, I mean, surely you mean the opposite. You can't possibly have an Israeli-Palestinian settlement as long as Hamas, which has a veto on such a settlement, is being financed by the Iranians, and the Iranians are encouraging Hamas to take the most extreme and barbaric approach to this. Surely what you mean is you've got to sort out Iran before you could have any hope of an Israeli-Palestinian state. But no. The administration is committed with an obsessively fixed idea to the notion that you have to get a settlement. Israel has to make the concessions, whatever they might be, to get a settlement with the Palestinians in order to address this looming catastrophe. And Obama has, let's say, an existential interest in this catastrophe. The American press is already describing Afghanistan as his Vietnam. The Iraqi withdrawal is turning into a civil war. These things are beginning to affect his popularity, which is falling, partly motivated by the economic situation, but partly clearly motivated by serious lack of competence in addressing the issues of the region. And if Pakistan blows up, it'll be all the worse. The more the Muslim world blows up, the more there will be pressure on Israel. Now, we happen to have the great misfortune that Obama himself has personal qualities which we should have understood earlier. And the American Jewish leadership bears considerable responsibility for failing to understand the dangers. I want to discuss Obama for a second in order to alarm you a bit about how bad things are, but then I want to explain why Obama's personality is really not the issue by itself. Let's look at who he is. we have something of an anomaly with Barack Obama. Where did this guy come from? He never passed a single piece of legislation. He never wrote an important article as a constitutional lawyer. He never expressed an opinion. He has no background. He's a blank slate, as he said himself, upon which he encouraged Americans to write their hopes and dreams. He's the most gifted political manipulator that American politics has ever produced. Though in a sense, he's really not a product of an American politics. I'm sure you've all seen movies in which a shipwrecked sailor or an adventurer encounters a Neolithic tribe and becomes their king. Well, this is kind of the opposite. You've got a third world guy who's like a third world anthropologist studying us who's come and become our king. It's a reversal of that. Let me tell you something about Barack Obama, because given the lack of public record, we go for what we can about him. And it's sort of interesting. His mother, well, was the kind of girl I remember at university during the 1960s, very left-wing, who believed in the virtues of the third world people's struggle against imperialism and colonialism. And we used to talk about the phrase back then was putting your body on the line, which means sleeping with third world guys. And Obama's mother, you have to say, was a woman of principle. She walked the walk as well as talked the talk, and she liked third world guys. So at 18 at University of Hawaii, she married this Kenyan, who was Obama's father, who dumped her and the kid. And then she married an Indonesian and went off to live in Indonesia. And then she dumped Obama on her grandparents and went off to Indonesia to write a doctoral dissertation about the heroic efforts of third world people to preserve their identity against the evils of globalization. And Obama sat there having been abandoned by father, stepfather, and mom, learning, as many children do who are abandoned by their parents, though he was abandoned by three, which is, well, quite a lot, to manipulate adults, and became an incredible talent for it. The man's not remotely stupid. He's an incredible talent. Now, where does Obama stand with respect to this? Well, in his first autobiography, Dreams of My Father, he describes as a young man arriving in Chicago and going to this housing project where poor black people lived, whom he was going to organize as a community organizer. And he compared them to the poverty there that he saw in Indonesia. And what he wrote is, "And yet, for all that poverty, there remained in their lives a discernible order, a tapestry of trading routes and middlemen, bribes to pay and customs to observe, the habits of a generation played out every day beneath the bargaining and the noise and the swirling dust. It was the absence of such coherence that made a place like Chicago so desperate." That's a two-sentence summary of his mother's doctoral dissertation. Obama doesn't like the United States very much. He doesn't like what you might call Anglo-Saxon colonialist imperialist civilization very much. He likes the third world. That's what he identifies with. And it was all, to the extent you could find anything in his own words and in his family's background, everything's perfectly coherent. I wrote an article a year and a half ago in which I said, well, you've got a third world anthropologist profiling us who really doesn't like the United States. It would be a very bad idea to make him president. But Obama's powers of persuasion were so much, so great, and perhaps the capacity for self-deception on the part of the American liberal leadership so great, that Obama persuaded the likes of Alan Dershowitz, Marty Peretz, the editor of the New Republic, to put their reputations on the line to support him. Now, for those of you who are right-wingers like me, let me say something in defense of liberal Jewish leaders in the United States with whom I bitterly disagree and who consider me an outcast and anathema. They wouldn't say anything nice about me, guaranteed. I'll say something nice about them. There's a reason why they hate the right wing so much, and that's because America during World War II took in only 21,000 Jewish refugees, the same as Switzerland, when we could have taken in all of them without noticing it in a country that size. And it was because of the right wing and its anti-Semitism that we failed to. Franklin Roosevelt's wife, Eleanor, who was a left-winger, begged Roosevelt to take in more Jews on a humanitarian basis, but right-wing senators came to Roosevelt and said, "Mr. President, if you do that, we'll go campaign for the Republicans. That's a make-or-break issue. That's a deal-breaker. We hate the Jews so much." That was the American right in 1941. And the older generation of American liberal leaders have not forgotten that. And their bitterness and rancor towards the right is as understandable as it's misguided. The investment that the American Jewish community has in liberalism and the civil rights movement in particular is so profound that its hope for an African-American president clouded its vision of what kind of snake we're dealing with. So at the moment, every Jewish organization in the United States and probably every congregation is in an anguished reevaluation of its relationship to liberalism and Barack Obama in the first place. It's very hard to know what the result will be, but I can see this in my own shul. I know it from every shul that I visited. It's a very difficult thing to grapple with. But in the meantime, we're seeing reports whose accuracy I can't attest to, and I can tell you right now, I've got no inside information, and I don't know any more than any careful reader of the internet will find out by looking through it. There are reports that at the United Nations opening session, Obama will come out with a final settlement plan for Israel, including the internationalization of Jerusalem, troops on Israel's borders, the entire package, which effectively would strip Israel of a great deal of its sovereignty and make it potentially indefensible. I don't know if that's true. I hope it's not true. I know many people are working furiously to warn Obama not to do that. He's got weaknesses. So I don't mean to panic everyone into saying, you know, Israel is going to be destroyed tomorrow or anything like that. But it is a very dangerous moment. We've got a very dangerous fellow there. But it's not just Obama. It's not just the very bad luck we've had to have someone who so profoundly identifies with the anti-colonialist people's struggle in the presidency. We've also got Afton Blattet. We have the most extraordinary willingness to cast dirt at the Jewish people and to lay the problems of the world at the door of Israel. And I maintain that it's all the fault of Melbourne, Australia, because you let Peter Singer loose. You could have put him, you know, had him locked up in some place where he would have been safe and comfortable and couldn't harm himself or others. But now he's at Princeton. He's the leading ethical philosopher at Princeton. What is the mindset behind Afton Blattet? What's the mindset behind the secular liberal elite, which takes the view that the worse the problems get in the Arab world and the crazier and more irrationally and more violently they behave, the more we have to pressure Israel? Well, it's called preference utilitarianism. That's Singer's phrase. And it's a very simple mindset, so let me walk you through it. From the Torah, we know what right and wrong is because it was revealed to us. There's never been a philosophy that could tell you what's right and wrong. There's never been, I mean, the Greeks never had the idea that if you have a Nobel Prize winning billionaire on the one hand and a blind cripple on the other, that the blind cripple not only has the same rights as the billionaire Nobel Prize winner, but also has the special love of God for the weak and powerless, for the widow and the fatherless. This idea from the Torah that a God of love has a special love for the weak, which I submit to you is the foundation of democracy, the sine qua non of modern civilization. This idea can't be proven by any philosophy. The Greeks naturally thought that the gods, their gods, loved beautiful and strong people and despised weak and ugly people because the gods were beautiful and strong and they liked people like them. It was a natural way to think. This idea, which Nietzsche despised as a slave religion, This idea is revealed and not provable. There's no philosophy that can prove it. And as the leading American pragmatist, Richard Rorty, said, I mean, no philosophy can tell you why you shouldn't step on the face of the weak. It just doesn't make any sense. So if you reject religion, Judaism and its offshoot in Christianity, if you reject the Torah as the premise of morality, what are you left with? Well, you can be left, first of all, there's no truth, because everyone has their own truth. I mean, if the truth isn't revealed, all philosophy can prove is that language can't really say anything clear, and no proposition can be proved completely. Philosophy as such leads you to a very sophisticated kind of despair. So the preference side of utilitarianism is it's a matter of the satisfaction of each person's individual preference or desires. It's completely subjective. What's right for anyone is what they say is right for them. And the other view of this is, the other side of it is the utilitarian side. Well, you know, if you've got a lot of people who are being hurt and a few people, well, you want the greatest good for the greatest number. But remember, good is defined perfectly subjectively. Now, Peter Singer, as many of you know, argues that a healthy pig is more valuable than a sick child, and that under certain circumstances, you'd kill a human baby to save a pig or a chimpanzee or a dog, because a 3-year-old dog is sentient, whereas a newborn baby isn't. It takes this to extremes. But preference utilitarianism is the logical result of rejecting religion. Secular society, which I consider an oxymoron. Secular society doesn't seem to really want to survive. I mean, once you throw out religion, people don't seem to like life terribly much. They stop having children. They'll disappear eventually, not fast enough for us to be out of danger, sadly. If you reject religion, if you reject revelation as a source of morality, I submit that Peter Singer's view, preference utilitarianism, in other words, pure subjectivity, it's whatever I like, and the greatest good for the greatest number, is what you're left with. There's just no other way to come up with an ethics in the absence of revelation. So Peter Singer, in that sense, deserves his fame because he was able to formulate a system which gives you some kind of guidance in the absence of revelation. Now, what does that mean for Israel and the world? Israel and the Muslims. If you're willing to kill a human baby to save a healthy pig, all the more so will you sacrifice 5 million Israeli Jews for the interests of 1.25 billion Muslims. And you protest, but Israel's not doing anything to hurt them. Excuse me, this is preference utilitarianism. There isn't any truth. It's simply what you think. Everyone has their own truth. Who are you to say what's true? What's true for the Muslims is that Israel has persecuted them. Just as Hitler said the Jews were our misfortune, the Muslims say the Jews are their misfortune. And who are you to argue with them? Because everything is a matter of preference. And if that's a matter of preference, well, you've got 5 million Jews and 1.25 billion Muslims. I mean, the numbers, you know, you can add, can't you? Those are the numbers. And you say, but we haven't done anything wrong. Well, it doesn't matter. It's not a matter of that. We've got to concern ourselves with the fact that you might have a humanitarian catastrophe, and that's not an illusion. A real humanitarian catastrophe with a fifth of humanity going into civil war and murder and violence, nuclear war, and all terrible things. And they're convinced that the problem would be ameliorated if only we put Israel down. We don't know if that's true, and perhaps it won't work, but it's worth a try because we're trying to save 1.25 billion people, and you know the 5 million just have to go by the boards. And that's where you get Obama's illogical assertion that if only you solved the Israeli-Palestinian problem, of course at the expense of Israel, you'd be able to deal with the Iranians. They might have a psychotic, paranoid response, but you take psychotic paranoia at face value because that's their preference. And ultimately, it's not Obama's personal prejudice against us, his third worldism, his leftism, his liking for the Muslims. It's the logical conclusion of the secular philosophical logic, which takes us to that extreme. And that's why Aftonbladet and their editors will say, well, you know, lay the problem at Israel's door. Secular Europe will throw us under the bus in a heartbeat. And that's why religious Christian America has been Israel's ally. So what do we do about this? Where do we stand? The people in the world who believe that truth is revealed, that God tells right from wrong, are people we can have a discussion with. The people who think that it's a matter of everyone's individual preference and it's the greatest good for the greatest numbers, that's preference utilitarianism, as in Peter Singer, whom you let loose, we can't have a discussion with, because it doesn't matter whether we're right, it doesn't matter whether we're holy, it doesn't matter whether our contributions to the human race are indispensable, our living witness to the God who gave us this morality is indispensable to human civilization, that doesn't matter. What matters is preference and the greatest good to the greatest number. You can't talk to people like that, because they'll throw you under the bus on the basis of their utilitarian calculus. Now, the reason Israel exists, as was said so eloquently before, is not simply because of our efforts, but because of a miracle. The first person, first country to recognize Israel, 11 minutes after its declaration of independence, was the United States of America. And the person who made that recognition was President Harry Truman. Now, Harry Truman was a devout Protestant, and he believed in the Bible, and he read his Bible. And his entire cabinet came to Truman and said, why would you possibly favor a few hundred thousand Jews against then tens of millions of Arabs who've got all this oil? What madness is that? Secretary of State George Marshall, chief of staff of the United States during World War II, author of the Marshall Plan, told Truman, if you recognize Israel, I will not only resign from the cabinet, but I will run against you. I'll support your opponent in the next election, no matter who he is, because it's so crazy. Truman ignored the advice of his unanimous advice of his cabinet, and because he was a Christian Zionist, recognized Israel. That's the miracle. The evangelical community in the United States, who have many issues, are in many ways a much more reliable source of support for Israel than the Jewish community, so many of whom have become either secular and complacent or even, sadly, hostile to Zionism. So what I submit to you is that those people who believe in right and wrong, who believe that there is a revealed truth, are people with whom we have a chance. Even if some of them are tainted by classical anti-Semitism, whereas this new preference utilitarianism, the secular logic, is worse than classical anti-Semitism because it will listen to no arguments of fairness or right and wrong. Israel, contrary to the Muslim world, contrary to Iran and Turkey and Algeria, which are really in the same shape, Israel is a demographic miracle. Contrary to what we were told in the early 1990s, when Rabin had to make that disgusting handshake with Yasser Arafat, Israel's demographics are the strongest in the industrial world. Israeli women, on average, are having 3 children in their lifetime, and it's not just the Haredi. There aren't enough of them to make up that number. It's everyone. Jews love life, which means they love babies. The Europeans are hating life, so they're not interested in babies. It's that simple. Our demographics are wonderful. And Israel's economy is not too bad either. It's a mini technological superpower. The state of Israel is doing better than it ever has, in a certain sense, since the Davidic kingdom, since that brief period where King David ruled a unified land without having to pay tribute to a foreign power. For a very short period of time, by some standards, the Jewish Commonwealth, Eretz Yisrael, is in better shape than it has been for the last 3,000 years. So there's a lot to be confident about. And although the collapse of the Muslim world is a matter of great concern because the secular logic lays its problem at our door, the idea that this overpowering, fecund, confident, militant Islam is going to overwhelm us turns out to be a complete illusion. What you have is the thrashing of a dying civilization. You've got to stand clear of its tail because it could crush you, but it is a dying civilization, and we're a living and vibrant one. Judaism has no problem engaging the modern world. It's very difficult to be a Muslim and be part of the modern world, but as we've shown, and as your community shows so wonderfully, it's possible to be Shirat Shemayim and be perfectly engaged in the modern world as a Jew. So I think we have everything to be happy about and everything to be hopeful about, but nothing to be complacent about. We're in a dangerous moment. There have been worse. You know, 1941 comes to mind. We've always had a dangerous moment. You know, for a Jew to come to Australia is a bittersweet thing. It's a wonderful country. I mean, it's got absolutely everything. And you think, you know, if only Moshe Rabbeinu had brought us here, they never would have gotten to us. They never found us. You know, we'd have been fine. But there's a reason that Moshe Rabbeinu brought us to Eretz Yisrael, which sits in the land bridge between Europe, Africa, and Asia, that everybody has to pass. God didn't choose us to be comfortable and complacent, hidden away somewhere. He chose us to be light unto everyone, which means we are exposed. If we're exposed, we're vulnerable, we're at risk. So we'll always be at risk. I don't believe that until the Messiah comes, Jews will cease to be at risk. We have specific risks now. We have means of addressing them. And as long as the diaspora community stands shoulder to shoulder with the state of Israel, I believe we'll overcome them. And with that, I would like to thank you for your attention and tell you what a wonderful experience it's been to be with wonderful people like you. So thank you so much.